Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we talk Major League, well, Major and Minor League Baseball. I guess we could say Major League Baseball, of course, gets a lot of the fame. But our next guest knows the minor leagues where weird things happen and stars are born. Well, talking about the book Tales from the Dugout, 1001 Humorous, Inspirational, and Wild Anecdotes from Minor League Baseball. And our guest is Tim Haggerty. He's the broadcaster for the AAA El Paso Chihuahuas and has called professional baseball games since 2004. This is his second book. Tim's first is Root for the Home Team, Minor League Baseball's Most Off-the-Wall Team Names and Stories Behind Them. So we'll spend the rest of the show talking with Tim about baseball. So give us your goofiest baseball stories. What's something funny that happened when you were watching or playing baseball? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Tim Haggerty, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
So maybe you could start with how you came to write or got the idea for Tales from the Dugout.
Well, in addition to broadcasting games, I've always loved baseball stories and baseball history. And in 2012, when researching something else, I came across this newspaper archive from the 1880s. A Texas League game got delayed this day in Austin when a wild bull ran on the field. And I thought, I do this for a living, and I've never heard this story before. So as you were talking about in your intro, Major League Baseball gets so much attention, but there are so many fun, interesting stories from Minor League Baseball that a lot of sports fans don't know about. So that was the inspiration.
I got to tell you, I've really, really had a lot of fun with this book. Give us a preview of how the book's laid out.
It has a lot of illustrations, which was what I hoped for it. HarperCollins did a great job with its illustrations. So it's 1001 quick stories. Most are just a paragraph or two with a catchy headline above and many illustrations throughout the book.
And the illustrations, you know who did them? Did one person do them or did they?
Yes, it's an illustrator named Ben Sampson. Through the wonders of publishing, we've never met. He lives in Virginia. He did a great job. Some people that have read this book have asked me if I did the illustrations. No, absolutely not. I have no drawing ability at all.
Well, I think it's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, and you're right. The illustrations, the great headlines, and you've done a nice job of summarizing these stories, which are, there's so many of them. Why do you love baseball?
Well, I've done about 1,000 of these, Larry, and I've never really thought about it that way. Why do I love baseball? I think like a lot of people, I was drawn to it as a kid. I liked the other sports, but I, as a kid, frankly, was obsessed with baseball. Passionate probably wouldn't be the word. It would be obsessed. I would devour the box scores. I collected baseball cards. I'd mail them off to players seeking autographs. And then as I got into broadcasting, I recognized that that passion could become a career. And my childhood obsession with memorizing players and rosters has actually helped me in my career, because now I'll be covering a game and a scout will come in and he'll introduce himself and I'll say, oh, you played for the Brewers in the 90s, didn't you? And he sort of is taken aback. You know, these aren't famous players, but because I really was into the rosters and the players, I think that now helps me as an adult.
I have had a lot of fun at minor league games, but in your words, describe what's so special about them.
The word community comes to mind. I'm sure many of your listeners enjoy following the Brewers, but there's also something about the team in Beloit and having Beloit across that jersey. That is your local team. And I think also it's more fun. I was broadcasting a game in 2015, and there was a between innings wiener dog race, and one of the dogs got loose and began scampering around the infield. And I'm calling this game, I'm calling a wiener dog delay. And I remember thinking, this is a lot more likely to happen in El Paso than it is at Yankee Stadium.
Scott sent us an email. He thinks the weirdest minor league team name is the Beloit Sky Carp.
I love their logo, and I've heard their new stadium is beautiful. I know for years they were hoping to get a new one. In fact, the Sky Carp are mentioned in my book. Their new ballpark, which opened in the past couple of years, as you know, Beloit is right on the state line, and it's actually just a street away from Illinois. So foul balls leave the Sky Carp Park, bounce on a street, and go into a different state.
Just off the what was speaking in those terms for just a minute, I was reading one where which involved the a home run that went 200 miles.
Yes, this was in 1982. Randy Bush was playing for Toledo. They're at Charleston, West Virginia, and there was a railroad track behind the right field wall. And Bush hit a high, soaring home run that left the stadium and landed in a moving coal train that did not stop for 200 miles. So he hit a home run that went 200 miles across West Virginia.
Oh, man. Tim Haggerty, our guest today, in his book, Tales from the Dugout, 1001 Humorous, Inspirational, and Wild Anecdotes from Minor League Baseball. It's great to have him with us. Maybe you've got an experience of your own. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Several of the dugout stories actually feature teams from Wisconsin. You mentioned the Sky Carps. The Brewers played a game with yellow baseballs in 1928. They were called the Milwaukee Brewers back then, I believe. Why did they use balls that were yellow?
This was an experiment to see if it would be easier to see for the players and harder to stain with dirt. It was on August 28th, 1928, a game between Louisville and Milwaukee. And the one thing that I was really trying to pin down in researching this was, why was it only one game? And my assumption is it didn't work too well because they did not continue the trend of using yellow baseballs. But yes, the team was called the Milwaukee Brewers. And that was a fun thing researching this book, was just seeing how much baseball history there is in Wisconsin before the Brewers arrived in the major leagues.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as we're on Wisconsin, let's go to the Wausau Timberjacks. They lost some of their clothes in June of 1940. I don't know if you can recall that from your 1001 tales, but do you know what happened there?
Yes, these days players will go to the ballpark in their street clothes, and then in the nice clubhouses, they get dressed into their uniform. But in 1940, players actually got changed at the hotel, so they showed up to the park in uniform. So this day in 1940, Wausau is playing a road game in Superior. And as the game unfolded across town, the hotel burned down. And all of the players' personal clothes were lost in the fire. So these poor guys are wandering around town looking for a new hotel, and they're still in full uniform.
The hotel burned. Oh, my goodness. Oh, and years later, there's another Wausau story in there. A Wausau team was up to some mischief. The Timbers didn't want to play a game in South Bend, Indiana, I think.
That's right. It was a doubleheader. The players didn't like the idea of this tiring doubleheader, so they hatched a scheme to break into the ballpark on this rainy night and pull the tarp off the field. Therefore, the field just got pelted by rain. It was uncovered. And they thought they pretty much got themselves a rainout. Well, South Bend had the last laugh. They had a devoted ground crew that went to work on the field, and they played the doubleheader on that soggy field, laughing at these players that didn't want to be there.
Oh, man. And let's see. I'm trying to think of some other Wisconsin ones. The Beloit Brewers Forgot some safety measures on opening night in, I think it was 1982.
That's right. They forgot to install the netting behind the ballpark or behind home plate in front of the stands at the ballpark. And as those who attend ball games know, that's a spot that you want to have covered. The ball goes flying back there on foul balls. Luckily, after one foul ball, they realized their mistake and put up this netting.
God, there's so many different things that can happen at a game. I was at a Brewers game once, and there was an older fella sitting there, and a foul ball bounced on somewhere and landed right between his feet. And he didn't even realize. And then suddenly there's a ball between his feet. And then two innings later, he's having a beer and he's talking to the guy that's next to him and he's not paying any attention. And a foul ball lands literally in his beer cup. So he got two foul balls, neither one he knew was coming. And he wound up with one of them right in his beer cup. Were there a lot of, you know, in your time, and you've been announcing now for a long time, have there been many injuries in your experience between spectators and teams?
I wouldn't say many, and this became a really big topic around 5 years ago when Major League Baseball mandated that netting went to the edge of the dugouts. So both in the minor leagues and in the major leagues, there's now more protection than there was even a decade ago, which to me was a great idea. Players are stronger than ever. That ball is traveling with a high rate of speed, and that's made a big difference. And I keep thinking about the odds of that one gentleman getting two foul balls in one game. I mean, that,
that is rare. How many games I've been to, I've been to a lot of games, and I've never gotten a foul ball. We were at a Brewers-Cubs game once, and a Cubs player at the end of an inning threw the ball. We were up about 15 rows, I think, and behind the dugout, and the player threw the ball up. And fortunately for us, the Cubs fans that were sitting in front of us had all gotten up to go to the bathroom because it was the end of the inning, and he threw that up, and my daughter one-handed it. So she got one. She got one, and it was fired up there pretty good. So she got a little round of applause from the people around us who were still there that she actually caught that ball. And she's gotten a few others before games because she'll go down and ask players for balls, and sometimes she'll get one and then she'll get it autographed. So I've got a bunch of balls, but I've never had one in my own hands, unfortunately. Tim Haggerty is our guest. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We're talking about his book, Tales from the Dugout, collection of minor league baseball's wackiest moments through the decades. I know he's got a list of some of his favorite stories of all time, and I'm going to get to that. And certainly, if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Tim. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're hearing about a few of the wacky baseball stories from the book Tales from the Dugout. Author Tim Haggerty is our guest. He's the broadcaster for the AAA El Paso Chihuahuas, has called professional baseball games since 2004. So I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. Tell us about your favorite minor league team, or give us a tidbit of wacky baseball experiences or history that you might have been involved in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email. The email address, ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Well, let's take a call. Mike in Brookfield, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
So I mentioned to your screener that my two stories are intensely personal, so I didn't know whether they were appropriate or not, but one was in back in October of 82. I was in the stands when we won the pennant, and I jumped out on the field, and I was probably the third or fourth person on the field, and as I jumped from the outfield and ran across, I made it to the first base line, and I went to hurdle the fence, and I got tackled by a Permar security guard. So I had a strong memory of that particular day. And then of course, by the time that he was doing that, there were another, I don't know, 800 people on the field. So, the other was back in August of 2000. I was with a friend. We were in the seventh row right behind the dugout, and Jeremy Burnitz somehow lost control of his bat, and the bat bounced off the dugout, and I one-handed it, but I one-handed it right in front, about 4 inches in front of this 8-year-old kid's face.
Oh.
And I stood there raising the bat over my head and kind of looking around, and I looked down at this kid who was looking at me with these big eyes going, like, you know, can't I get the bat? And I was like, crud, I got to give the bat to this kid. So I gave the bat to the kid. So. I can't even count how many other games that I've enjoyed, both at County Stadium, at Miller Park, and American Family Field. So I absolutely love the Brewers. I'm so happy that we have them here.
Oh, Mike, thank you very much for calling. And you have some fan stories. Well, you may have just some that you've observed in your years of announcing, Tim. Any come to mind?
When you talk about fans, actually the oldest story in the book is one that I enjoy. It took place in Wheeling, West Virginia, and it goes all the way back to 1877. And the team there, the Wheeling Standards, had a 4th of July picnic. The players were involved, and they had this contest to see who could catch a greased pig, and the winner got to keep the pig. And what I love about this story is that there's sometimes a perception that baseball teams are doing whatever it takes to get headlines and sell tickets. Well, that's not new. They've been trying to do that since the 1870s.
I there was another fan one that I really liked. Let's see if I can remember it all. It was in Birmingham Barons. The first baseman, Norm Zalkin, I believe, tumbled into the stands trying to catch a foul. You could tell that story.
So it was 1950, Birmingham's first baseman, Norm Zalkin, as you said. He tumbles into the stands trying to catch a foul ball, and he lands on this woman named Janet Mooney. They begin speaking. He asks her on a date, and they got married 2 years later. He met his wife while trying to catch a ball.
Oh, man, a great story. And Mike in Brookfield, thanks again for sharing your stories. Jeff in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Well, thank you, sir. I have an all-time favorite story to tell. I was at Milwaukee County – no, it was at Miller Park, and we were watching the Brewers play a team. I don't remember who it was, but we were just off the first base side in a box seat with a couple friends, and the stadium was kind of quiet. And the guy at bat, his name was Jeffers. And, you know, my name's Jeff, right? Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, well, this is a cool moment. So I yelled out, I said, home run, we need a home run. And everyone looks at me like, why are you being so noisy? The next pitch, the guy hits a home run. And everyone in the stands was looking at me like, how did you predict that? And I was like, hey, I called it. You know, it was fun. That was a great moment.
Oh, Jeff, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I don't know if you've got any stories like that in your book. I'm trying to remember, but I don't think so. Maybe you've got something that sort of relates, Tim.
Yeah, Larry, when we talk about fan stories, one that comes to mind is Larry Trujillo. In the book, we call him the luckiest baseball fan in New Mexico because the Albuquerque Isotopes had a contest. You enter your name, and your name gets drawn. And in that inning, if the Isotopes hit a grand slam, a pretty rare thing, teams will typically only do that a few times a year. If they hit a grand slam in your inning, you win a new car. Well, on August 1st, 2005, Trujillo enters the contest. They pull his name, and Albuquerque hits a grand slam. He won a new car. He goes back to the ballpark on May 5th, 2006. His name gets drawn again. Again, Albuquerque hits a grand slam. This guy won two cars in two separate contests at the ballpark 8 or 9 months apart.
Oh, my goodness. That is amazing. I don't remember reading that well. There's 1,001 stories in here, and I thought I'd gotten through all of them, but I've forgotten that one. You had another story that I liked a lot that involved a turkey, a actual turkey.
Yes, Chattanooga had this very eccentric owner that was always trying to get headlines with bizarre things, Joe Engel. So in 1931, this owner, Joe Engel, traded his shortstop to Charlotte for a turkey. He then served the turkey at a winter sports writer's banquet. And when asked, why did you trade your player for a turkey? He said, the turkey was having a better year. Oh. Ouch, right? Pretty offensive. Your player had a worse season than a turkey.
Oh, boy. And some the payments, too. Some players weren't necessarily receiving dollars all the time.
Yes. Well, first off, contracts, as you might imagine, were a lot less 100 years ago. There was a pitcher named C.C. Hodge who had his contract selected for 25 cents by a team in Massachusetts in 1906. But there have been a lot of interesting transactions, including one I wanted to mention involving Milwaukee. In 2019, a Milwaukee Milkmen pitcher, the independent league team near Milwaukee, this pitcher, Miles Smith, was traded to Long Island for a player to be named later. Well, a couple months pass, and Milwaukee decides they need some pitching depth. So they call up Long Island, and they sent back Smith as the player to be named later. He got traded for himself.
Oh, man. How did the teams get away? I mean, there was another one with involved prunes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's exactly right. That was a Memphis and San Francisco trade in 1933. San Francisco acquired Memphis first baseman Jack Fenton for a case of prunes. And, yeah, it was part of a series of bizarre trades we tried to include in the book. There was another one where a player got traded for a plate of beans. We have a fun illustration in the book of this one, but it was Wichita Falls and San Antonio. And Wichita Falls had a pitcher, Yul Moore, and the ownership of Wichita Falls was tired of him. He wasn't pitching well. He was a complainer. They wanted to get rid of him. And Wichita Falls owner is venting about this disgruntled pitcher over dinner with the San Antonio team boss. San Antonio says, to be honest with you, we could use him. The Wichita Falls boss says, if you pay for this plate of beans I'm eating, he's yours. So a pitcher got traded for a plate of beans.
Things must have been, could they get away with that in this day and age? I mean, aren't there more restrictions on deals like this?
For sure. There are some modern examples. 1997, the San Diego Padres traded a minor league catcher, Sean Mulligan, to Cleveland for a used treadmill. San Antonio or San Diego's former ballpark, their current ballpark is only 20 years old and is stunning, but this is their older ballpark, and they needed some fitness equipment. Cleveland needed a catcher, so they traded a player for a used treadmill. But I think, Larry, to your question to why it doesn't happen as much, is that there's some sensitivity toward the player. It sort of is embarrassing for the player to be traded for a treadmill. You know that's going to get national attention. So I think out of respect for the players, you don't hear about players being traded for a plate of beans anymore.
Oh, man. Let's go to Tim in Viroqua. Tim, hi. Thanks for calling.
How are you doing today, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Good. Hey, I just tuned in, but it sounded like you're telling stories about County Stadium.
Well, a few of those have come in, but go right ahead with yours.
Okay. Well, it was 1977. I was 17 years old. My buddies and I decided to skip school and go watch a doubleheader. We did. That night I'm sitting in the family room with my dad watching the news. And who do they show on the TV during the doubleheader? All the boys, you know, in 1977 doing what boys do. And my dad just looked at me and said, looks like he had a good day at school today. So that's it.
Thanks, Tim.
Just fond memories.
Oh, man. Of
you
all
know, Larry,
of all the shots they could show, they have to show that one.
Tim's story reminds me of a great one, Larry. In 2002, the Cincinnati Police Department was looking for this alleged criminal, and a Cincinnati police officer sitting in the stands, and they're doing the kiss cam where they show fans next to each other and try to urge them to kiss. Well, they show this person on the kiss cam, and it's the guy that the police are looking for, and they walked up to his seat and arrested him. Got busted on the Jumbotron. Much like Tim years earlier for skipping school.
Oh, John in Janesville, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Say, County Stadium, a number of years ago, we were on the first base sideline up about 15, 20 rows, and a foul ball was hit and went way up in the air, and we kind of gave up on it because it was going up in the upper deck. Well, in front of me was a lady that she was a fairly large lady. So we gave up on the ball, and so we turned and we're just going to watch the next pitch. And this ball bounced back down and came down, and it actually, and she was turning as well, and it landed in her seat. and she sat on it. And she didn't realize that the ball was there.
Oh.
And so we were just going to wait, and we were discussing whether we should let her know about it, or if when she gets up, we'll just take the ball, you know. And we probably did the right thing, and we did
told
her know that, we told her, and, you know, so that was as close as I've been to a foul ball, I guess.
John, thanks for calling. Oh, man, a weird fan incident. Any other weird fan incidents that come to your mind, Tim?
Well, all these great foul ball stories and fan incidents, I think about Ann Kenyon. She was 91 years old when she caught a foul ball barehanded at a San Jose Giants game in 2012. She got all sorts of publicity for it, and the team had her come back a few weeks later and throw out a ceremonial first pitch. This was not an arcing, easy catch. This ball had some force behind it, and a 91-year-old great grandmother caught it.
Oh, what a great story. We had a story. I had a story in my mind from as I looked through the book. Mickey Mantle is featured in one story when he was playing for the Class D. Yeah, was it 49? Yes, go ahead and tell that story.
Yeah, he was playing Class D ball, the Independence Yankees. He hit a deep fly ball to the outfield, and the center fielder, Bill Hornsby, lost sight of the ball. It bonked him in the head and knocked him unconscious. And Hornsby is the son of Rogers Hornsby, one of the best players in the history of the game. And Mantle then went on to be the same. So you have a great Hall of Famer knocking out a Hall of Famer's son.
And in the and Mantle ran around the bases and got a home run out of it, didn't he?
Exactly. Yeah, there's no stopping. When you're a base runner, no matter what is going on with that fielder, you keep on running. You'll have your sensitivity later for the player. But, you know, it reminds me of 1990. There was a AAA Iowa game, and Indianapolis had an outfielder, Jim Steels, who surged back toward the wall, and he collided with the fence so hard that his spikes got caught on the fence. And he got stuck. So the ball is resting near him as the Iowa player is racing around the bases, but he's stuck to the wall. The ground screw had to go unhinge him from the wall.
Oh, man. There's a few of those. Bobby Cherry got his arm caught in a wall, if I'm not mistaken, through the wall once.
Yeah, that was in 1951 at Salt Lake City. And same thing. It must be maddening for the outfielder. His arm is stuck through this wooden fence. He can't move. And he can see the ball. And he so desperately wants to get that ball and throw it in because he sees his opponent rounding the bases. But he can't because he's stuck to the fence. Of course, there's the famous play, Rodney McRae. You've probably seen this highlight. He was the outfielder for Vancouver in 1991 in Portland, Oregon, who ran back and ran through the outfield wall. It was a wooden fence, and he blasted through it. And luckily, to baseball fans everywhere, there was a news photographer there for a local Portland, Oregon affiliate that captured this. I had a chance to interview McRae about being known as the guy who ran through the wall, and he said, "I made a mistake. I ran through the Flavor Pack meat sign. Had I run through a Pepsi or Coca-Cola sign, I'd be a millionaire right now."
Oh, man. There was one about jail. There was the Blue Sox? Spent a night in jail?
Yes. Love this story. Abilene is visiting Corpus Christi, Texas in 1956. They arrived for a road series, and every hotel room in the whole city was taken. The manager, Al Evans, made some phone calls and booked the team overnight in a county jail. So the players slept in jail cells instead of a hotel for their road trip.
Oh, man. Several of your stories from the early 20th century mentioned baseball bans. Tell us more about those laws.
Yeah, in many cities, in some cases states, baseball was not allowed on Sundays. And sometimes, well, numerous things would happen. There was a team in Ottawa, for example, that would move their Sunday home games across to Quebec because they were allowed to play on Sundays there. Other times, teams would actually try to avoid this rule. For example, Schenectady in 1903 actually had the entire team arrested when they got caught playing a home game on a Sunday. The temptation was there because they're still selling tickets. But, the entire team got arrested May 25th, 1903, when they were caught playing on a Sunday. And there was also a game in New Jersey. They wanted to get this game in. They did not want to be arrested for playing on a Sunday. So as fans were entering, everybody agreed to be silent for the whole game. We do not want to draw attention to the ballpark because we're playing on a Sunday. So it was a silent ballpark.
Oh, man. And there was one other one, a Brockville Pirates pitcher threw something other than a baseball during a game.
He threw an apple. This was in 1936. John Grilly, as a prank, tucked an apple either into his pocket or into his glove. As he prepared to make the next pitch, he held on to the actual baseball and pitched an apple. And the Ogdensburg batter took a swing and smashed the apple. The fans thought it was hysterical. The umpire did not. The pitcher got ejected for this apple scheme.
And there was another one, just one more here, that involved two Cowboys with pistols.
Yes. There was an umpire named Steamboat Johnson throughout the early 1900s. who had some crazy stories. He umpired more minor league games than anyone in history. And one of his wild stories took place in 1912. Denver was at St. Joseph, Missouri, and there were some cowboys in the stands who had bet money on the game. Deep in the game, a high fly ball is traveling out toward the center field. And if this ball goes over the fence, these cowboys are about to lose some money. So Steamboat tells this story, and this appeared in newspaper archives. He says this truly happened, that the cowboys pulled out a pistol, shot the live fly ball, blew it to smithereens as it was flying in the air. So the umpire doesn't know what to do. There's no rule in place if a ball is shot as it's flying. So Steamboat said it's a home run because the ball disappeared from his view.
One of the many stories. Tim, I hope your book is selling well. It's a lot of fun, and I really appreciate your time today talking with us about your book, Tales from the Dugout. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you, Larry. I enjoyed it.
Tim Haggerty, his book, Tales from the Dugout. Get a look at it. It is a very fun read. Looking ahead to tomorrow, veterinarian Bill Stork, Dr. Bill Stork, back with us to talk about the best ways to keep your pet on your property and what to know before installing an invisible fence. We'll answer your other questions as well. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.